streaming. So again, if anyone is just participating via the streaming, you are fit, may email me comments. I've been watching my email, and supposedly none have come through, so I hope that is because no one's actually sent them, and that they're not actually getting lost somewhere. But I thought that would be it. Okay, the Section 5, Duties of ETCs. There were a few comments I know that were directed at these, so if anyone would like to address issues there, you're welcome to.
I think from our perspective, my comment may have been because I don't know NLAD, but you talk about that once a participant has been de-enrolled, then the federal ETC can only process an initial application. And so if a participant is de-enrolled, then they have to go through the responsible agency. So how does the ETC, an ETC, know that someone has been de-enrolled if, for example, I were to get de-enrolled and then go to a different provider? Does the NLAD say that this person has been de-enrolled from someone else?
Let me briefly respond to that, a little bit out of character from what I said at the start of the meeting, that we wouldn't make decisions. In reading those comments, we recognize that there's a logical issue there that we have to address. So we will be following up on those in a little bit more detail.
Thank you.
Other comments are
in the first section. We're looking at the duties of ETCs, correct?
Yes.
Okay. In the first section, this is talking about the monthly list that we would send, which does just say changes in status. So that's for state ETCs. So that tells me you're not looking for a complete list, but just a change list.
Right.
But under that, I know we noted there's one that says changes in the size of the households, and we would not know that information. We wouldn't have that. So I suggested that be removed. And then, and it's unclear to me where in number two it said the record sent shall contain the full information for each participant as required by this rule. If that's talking about the format of the file that we should send monthly, I didn't know where that was outlined. I didn't find that outlined in the rule anywhere, so it was unclear to me exactly what that meant.
We can certainly put a note to clarify exactly what should be sent and how, because that should be in the rules for me.
And then URTA under Section 8, this just gets back to the list that we were talking about last time. We just need to make this section consistent with
whatever we end up with there. Okay, very good.
I think some others commented on this too, but on point 4, where we say that each state shall add the discount to the customer's account as directed by the agency within 2 business days. We suggest a 5 business days generally.
Is the what are the federal guidelines on that? Is it 5?
Well, this is talking about adding Lifeline, and the federal rules really only address the removal of Lifeline because you in LAD or USAC or whatever. But it's 5 business days is what.
All for removing. But the federal rules don't specifically address how quickly it should be added.
No.
The federal rules say you have to
give them full month credit.
Add the customer to NLAD before you provide the discount. So it's in the carrier's best interest to do it as soon as possible.
Okay.
Yeah, as far as the NLAD is concerned, that's true.
I'm sorry, and the division just did remind me that you had the whole benefit for the month. So I guess it's not.
It's not prorated.
It's not a prorated process, so I guess the number of days here wouldn't be a real issue as compared to a de-enrollment type deadline. So. All right, other other comments on that section?
Are we still in section 5?
Yeah, sorry, duties ETC, section 5.
Yeah, we had a comment under section B, the retention of supporting documentation. It looked to me like it said the proposed rule suggests that federal ETC shall retain supporting documentation, but I think that ETCs are prohibited from retaining copies of the documentation under federal rules.
Yes, and in your comments, if I'm remembering right, what you pointed out was the rule said that they maintain a record of the source?
Yeah. The records, they need to maintain accurate records detailing what the data source, so what they looked at, but not the actual.
Not the actual document.
And is that consistent with other parties understanding that rule? I'm assuming it probably is. But
yes.
The division also made mention of retention in that there are state grammar rules and archive requirements that need to be maintained. So we suggest that information also be added. They have to keep the documentation in terms of what they reviewed and any other information they have for the Lifeline participant for as long as that person is on Lifeline, and then once they are off Lifeline, it needs to be at least for 3 years after for the state requirement.
So one thing is an ETC that we can use as proof is if we sent you a customer data and you responded back in the file and said, yes, they're in the DHS database, or DWS database, we can retain that and cite that. We dip the state database, and that is our proof.
Yeah.
No.
In a scenario where we used a call center.
Not for any federal.
Customer's application, submitted all the data to you, you responded back, we would then take that data file and cite that as the proof that we dip the database and it's a federal requirement.
I'm not convinced that's accurate. We in our role are still having the initial determination for a federal ETC being done by the federal ETC, not the state administrator.
But can't they query to the DWS that they meet the or that they participate in one of the programs? Is that not?
I thought that there
well,
was.
Well,
it's only after the fact. They've got to establish eligibility before they ever send stuff to DWS.
Right.
Yeah, they got to maintain the documentation they need for the FCC because the customer is sending them the application, the certification, and the stuff. What they are saying is, okay, then every month I send you all the ads and I tell you, and if they send if they only send back the ones we ought to drop, then what you've done is you've validated those customers as well. So that's an extra step, and so they can maintain that.
Yeah.
You know, if the FCC comes and audits them, they'll say, okay, here's my documentation that we received, but also the state went through this process.
Right.
I think that's what they were saying, and it gives them an extra add of evidence that the customer was validated, because that's what you're doing. Mm-hmm. They're not dipping the database directly, but you are inquiring, doing what DWS needs to do to validate. And if they're not, if they don't come back from you saying they're not on it, then they're on it, right?
Well, you actually do when the verification is done. There's the list gets broken into approved, not.
Okay, so you send back the whole list and say these are approved, these are not approved.
Yeah.
Well, see, that gives the wireless ETC additional evidence to show that they are qualified. But
it's additional.
You know, the FCC won't, I don't think, let them if that's the process, because this is kind of a quasi-process. It's not exactly mirroring the federal. And, I mean, that's really not the commission's issue. I mean, it's between the FCC, do you have the right documentation? I assume they would still require them to say, do you have an application where the customer certified?
Right. Yes, the FCC requires us that when a state database is available, and that's what this is functioning as, dip the state database.
It's not available. It's not available to a federal ETC.
So when we submit our monthly batch of data, are you saying that's not dipping the state database for eligibility?
See, in that sense, it is.
But what I'm understanding you guys are saying is that for a federal ETC, that they, when they receive an application from a customer, they should also be getting the documentation of eligibility and signing that customer up for Lifeline benefits if they meet those criteria. But then they will be sending you a monthly file of everyone they have signed up, and you're just kind of doing an after-the-fact eligibility confirmation based on your records. And that's where we got into that discussion earlier, where if your records say they're not receiving any state benefits, then you're going to have a mismatch between what that customer told that carrier versus what you have in your database.
But if the DWS is doing the check anyway, I don't understand why they can't do the check for the they're ultimately doing the check for the federal ETC. So why do we have to have two different processes? I mean, you're calling it a verification, but the fact of the matter is they're doing exactly what they do for the wireline ETCs. They're just doing it within 30 days.
Yeah. But from a USAC FCC perspective, in order for that dip for the federal ETCs to count as verifying eligibility through the database, it would have to occur before the federal ETC provided the Lifeline discount to that customer. And it sounds like that the federal ETC is providing the Lifeline discount 30 days or so, or before they verify a second time that consumer's eligibility. The initial verification check is when the customer goes to that federal ETC and provides a copy of their SNAP card or provides a copy of the Medicaid card, because that's what's triggering that initial Lifeline discount.
I guess I'm confused as to whether the person on the phone prior to you today was in, maybe are they not giving the discount and they're waiting to get the dip back from the state? I just am not clear on that.
We can do it two different ways. In a live enrollment, we would absolutely look at the proof, verify the customer live, and then enroll the customer. But possibly in a call center enrollment, we would take their information and then submit it back to the state for verification. So in the scenario where we batch the file, and I may have missed this in our prior conversation, but my understanding was that we can submit a batch file more than once a month to the state. So we could submit a daily batch file of subscribers that you would verify and then send back to us. So in a call center environment, that would be the verification.
So you wouldn't sign them up for Lifeline until you got notice back from the state they were qualified?
That is correct. That would meet our compliance plan.
So that's kind of like the nose of the camel and the tent on DWS doing the whole thing.
Yeah.
Well, let me just again say we're not deciding anything today.
Only live stuff they wouldn't do.
The commission will take that input and they'll write a rule that they think is right.
I guess I'd like to make one additional comment. When we have a separate process for the state, wireline ETCs and wireless ETCs.
Well, it's state participants state and federal participants. It could be either kind.
Okay. So, well, when we have separate processes for that, the federal-only ETCs can do live enrollment if they verify themselves.
If they verify themselves, absolutely.
ETCs cannot do live enrollment. We take the application, we submit it to DWS. And so there is a little bit of a... It's not fair, whatever, for the state ETCs, only because there's a disadvantage. That's what I'll say. There's a disadvantage for state ETCs because customers who want immediate enrollment in Lifeline will go to the wireless or the federal-only ETCs. They won't get the additional state discount.
You've got to remember the history.
No, I know. I understand the history.
There's a reason why you're...
I'm just wondering it seems to me that the DWS is doing everything. They're doing everything for the wire or for the federal only that they're doing for the state. They're just not doing it
up front.
But yep. They take the applications for our wireline customers.
So they maintain the documentation. Yeah. So that's one difference. Plus, if the customer was income qualified, going through a wireless ETC, they send you over a file that says they were income qualified. You're not then getting them. So that one is just kind of like, well, we're not validating that one.
Yeah, we can't do anything about that.
Yeah, so there is a difference. And yeah, there is a disadvantage being able to live enroll, get them on it quicker, but we also, we get the state discount. So that, you know, I mean, it's, the bottom line is DWS isn't really in a position to do everything up front for everybody.
Nope.
That's the issue.
If I understand it correctly, we're responsible for putting the credit back to the, virtually the date of application, don't we?
Well, for the full month. You give it
for that month.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and the history is that the ILEX asked us, insisted, that we do it for them.
Absolutely.
And there isn't any way to make it the same, because DWS can't do it. All right, any other comments on that section, on the duties of ETCs?
Overlooking, I talked about the 5 business days on number 4. I'm looking at my markup, I don't know if it's, and, but the next one talks about the enrollment and also suggested, we're also suggesting 5 business days on that too. And I think there's that same issue with number 8, where, and that gets back to that whole list issue of the annual recertification that we talked about already.
Right,
and
we're going to make consistent with whatever the commission decides there, so that'll be reworked.
Okay, because I just put on there, it also says this list shall contain the full identifying information,
right,
and that's not real clear to me what that might be, so.
Right, so we'll do that. What, where was the other number of days? Which number was it?
It was 4 and 5. I believe both of those. 4 says 2 business days. 5 says within the next month's billing cycle, following notification. And I know the under federal rules, if we're noticed by USAC or the inlet, are the in our, you know, under recertification, we have 5 business days to de-enroll. So that would just kind of make all of that consistent. The enrollment, 5 business days. You might need to take a look at that, the gist.
Well, I guess I'm asking for clarification here. The discounts given in monthly blocks, in terms of your practice in other states, which discount do you take off? Say the billing cycle ends on the 15th, you've been given discounts, you get notified on the 13th to de-enroll. Do you take out that month? Do you take out the next month? What's the...
For the next month? Because they get the full...
When the state tells us, I don't know.
I mean, all this language was trying to get to is just say, don't give another discount.
Yeah, I think.
But I don't know what the best
thing says next month's bill cycle is, because if I get a notice today for April, and ours goes from the middle of the month to the middle of the month, they get that discount up through the middle of April, mm-hmm. and then from the middle of April on, they don't get the discount. Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the idea.
The rules. The Fed's intended. That's my interpretation.
And the other issue is
we don't prorate the credit,
right? Because you sometimes you have them prepay the service. Mm-hmm. You know, that way, if it's in the next billing cycle, it will take care of them.
It makes prepaid easier.
That's all this language was getting at. I'm just trying to figure out what
I'm
the best.
I'm trying to shift gears and think about it from the state perspective. And I know that we do have different dates, like you said. Like if we get it by the 20th, we may get it to the end
that's
of the month.
That's why it goes by billing cycle. It needs to be.
Okay.
So that they get the full credit for the bill cycle.
Well, then you don't give another billing
right
cycle
after.
Credit.
Right.
So are there other thoughts on that one? I mean, in terms of, does it make more sense to go days, or does it make more sense to do billing cycle? What's the... Are people not having an opinion? I think a few looks like, why am I still here? All right, we will take your comments into account and move on there. Any other comments on that section, the duties of ETCs?
Yes.
Okay.
Under 5B, number, let's see, number 4, so this is federal ETCs. Oh, you know what, this is, it's not specific to that, but I think we talked about this earlier, that both the state ETC, I mean, the state responsible agency and the federal ETC are going to query NLAD.
Yes.
And then the...
We definitely, throughout the whole rule, plan to clarify the NLAD role to the extent we can.
And then the, if I understand correctly, the ETCs will update in that. Is that
yes.
Correct? Yeah, because they won't allow all ETCs. They won't allow state administrator to do that.
Until the administrator does have the ability, but we don't have it right now. Yes.
Well, even
they
if
they won't give it right now. So
I can't. Did we talk about updating NLAD in this rule, or would that be covered under federal rule, so you don't really need to?
It's mentioned under bullet 6, under the state ETCs. It says each state ETC shall contemporaneously update the NLAD as of all changes.
Yes. And then the other thing I have is under number number 9, under federal ETCs. That would just be, that's the same issue on the dates of the data.
Consistent. Thank you. I'm trying to make these all consistent with whatever we decide. But it's good to know where they're all at. You have a comment?
Yeah, I'm just confused why the responsible agency is doing the annual certifications when they're not doing the certifications.
For the federals?
Yeah.
Because once we agreed to be the state administrator, we have to do the annual.
Not for the federal ETCs. Theoretically, in other areas of this
citation that says we don't.
Well, you're not certifying them at time of application. So, how do you take responsibility to be the certification afterwards?
Well, all I'm saying is our understanding that. That was one thing we had to do if we said we were a state administrator. But if you can point us to where it says we don't have to do that, that might be useful information.
Well, just to the layman here,
I gave up on layman's logic.
It appears. I'm reading your words. It appears that.
No, we definitely are saying
you're the state administrator for the state, for the state and federal ETCs, not the federal ETC.
Well, we're definitely saying that because of the wireless federal only. Sorry, I just did the wireless thing. She's laughing. That is their responsibility to certify initially. We want the current rule is saying that that's. Where that responsibility ought to be. But it was our understanding, and it may be erroneous, and we're happy to be corrected, that when we said we're the state administrator, when we opted into that role with the FCC, that we had to do annual certifications.
You at least had to do the annual certification. That's your understanding. Right. So do we know differently?
So if anybody wants to research that and let us know more.
Because if that isn't a requirement, it sounds like you wouldn't really care about not taking
well, I'm not saying I don't know what the commission cares one way or the other. I'm just saying that's a piece of information that would change our information set. I don't know how they would react to that. And you can certainly send it in if somebody finds something that they think is on point.
Well, they're
are there other comments on that section?
I had a question.
We can't hear you at all. We're just hearing static, basically. So you've got to either get on a different phone, or you've got to get closer to your phone, or you've got to speak a lot louder.
I actually changed phones, so I apologize. Is this better?
No.
Barely, but I think my ears might be better than a few others because I can make out you're talking, but some people here can't. So you can go ahead. But
number five, it says the EPC shall at least monthly send the file.
That changes.
The ETC, I just want to make sure, the ETC can send the file multiple times during a month. And I also want, and I couldn't find the correlating time frame for the response file. Will it be a one-to-one relationship for every file submitted? There will be a response file, or will the response files be periodic?
My guess, but this would be worked out by the commission at a later date, is that it would be a once a month.
Trying to go through the first half of the rules, it was indicated to us that it would be a one-to-one relationship.
Who did that?
Well, it's...
It was with Shauna.
Okay. Well, all I can tell you is that DWS is very concerned about the workload that the wireless programs can impose. They're not interested in adopting that workload. They've informed us through the contract negotiations that they simply will not adopt that workload. So my guess is that they will most likely say that their response is going to be once a month and that they'll collate that and do it as a batch. I don't know, but that was something that when we drafted this rule, we hadn't really anticipated that being an issue that would come up to this extent. So I can tell you that we'll check back with DWS, we'll talk with their administrators, we'll see what they're willing to do, but that we can't, as I mentioned at the start of the conversation, we can't order them to do anything.
Thank you.
Right now, if there's a file that comes, there is a one-to-one response. So if a file comes in, then there's a response to that file.
But we're only getting them from
one
carrier right now.
Right.
If they were getting daily files,
right,
they're not going to do that. Mm-mm. I'm getting that body language pretty clear.
Yes.
So we will follow up on that and find out what DWS is willing to do. Any other comments or clarifications or opinions on the duties section?
I had a question.
Might not have an answer.
That's okay. On number 9 under the state ETCs, in the same point as on 10 under the federal ETCs, where it talks about if we have a reasonable basis to believe that Lifeline or that the person is no longer qualified. I was just wondering, would that be like if we tried to enter them into the NLAD and they failed that, or like, or wireless carriers, there's that 60-day usage rule. I wasn't real sure what would fall under these. I wonder if you had any ideas.
Well, no. This was somewhat of
a
carryover from the previous rule. It's kind of a catch-all, simply that there was a sort of a due diligence thing, but I off the top of my head, I'm not given how much more detailed the system is going to be in terms of what checks are being done on an ongoing basis. I really would have a hard time coming up with an example there, so I'm not really sure. Yes.
Just comment on one. It could be that if the ETC knows that the customer has terminated their service completely, that they need to contact
their telephone service.
Yeah, their telephone service. Completely, then that information needs to go back to the responsible agency so that the information can be updated.
Now, is that something that, because this talks about within 2 business days,
would happen with their deletes and adds, though.
Yeah.
That's just normal course of business.
Yeah.
I mean, I know if you're a rural carrier with a relatively small area and you're reading your local paper and you realize that one of your customers just won the lottery.
As a rural carrier, we serve a large area, and we don't have a newspaper that's worth reading.
That's probably true. So there's my example gone.
They saw it on Facebook.
Anyway, we'll certainly, we'll look at that and let the decision decide if they want it or not.
Those were a couple of things that I thought of, was the inlet, if it rejects some, or, like I said, the usage issue.
We will investigate if needed, and we'll...
I don't know that I saw that specified, but that's in that 405E that we talked about for general, for the DM moment. Mm-hmm. So.
All right, well, thank you. Anything else on that one? Okay, on to Section 6, the features of the state lifeline, so not the federal, but just the state. Any, and actually, I guess a clarification point that, given the other comments earlier, CenturyLink had talked about the telephony versus the telephone service. Do any of your concerns with that earlier comment play into the definition, not the definition, but the description here of what constitutes lifeline service?
I think one comment that keep adding here that maybe goes back to the earlier point is just that we should recognize that I think it's 5419 prohibits regulation. Yeah, 5419.103 prohibits regulation of VoIP services with certain exceptions. And so just to make sure that the rule doesn't run afoul of that, whatever that means.
Okay.
Not sure we can go up with all the nuances of that. But.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of a legal question. I understand that statute. But, like, if we move away from a switch network and all we provide is VoIP, and so that's what the lifeline service is to the customer, I assume, pursuant to this rule, if we're going to get state discount, that then obligates us under the requirements of the rule. And so that's like, if you're going to get the discount, this is what you got to do.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that runs afoul with the
ETC.
The ETC state legislation on VoIP. So is that, that's what you're trying to get at, is this,
yeah,
how these going to fit together.
Put that on the table to think about, because in this case it's somewhat more of a, you know, let's say we're acting as a market participant, but it's not
and
providing a service or a benefit, I guess, that might require some action to get it.
I do think the other comments raise a point that we would like to hear your input on, and we're, like I say, we don't have a decision today on this, but this section is very much written with somewhat of a legacy network in mind. You know, it talks about a residential access line. Is that problematic, or is that something we deal with down the road if the world changes a lot more, or what are people's feelings on that?
I think you try to keep it broad, so however technically it's delivered to the customer.
So you'd say define it in terms of features that are delivered rather than the method of delivery.
That's more forward-looking, because that's the reality.
Wouldn't you just prefer to match it up with the federal rule, and whatever is acceptable under the federal rule is...
Yeah.
Well, the problem is we think there's a big value to having what looks like traditional telephone service in terms of our state benefit. This is talking about the state program, not the federal. Things like unlimited local calling, I doubt there's going to be very many, at least not for several years, wireless federal onlys that want to be doing something like that. So this section is looking just at what you do to qualify for the state benefit, not for the federal.
Well, but I think what AT&T would recommend is, you know, the Fed seems to be going towards technology neutrality in that, recognizing that, you know, perhaps best to let whatever technologies are going to be predominant just based on their own merits, and rather than trying to separate that for this kind of a purpose for LifeLine.
I think CenturyLink
That would be our recommendation anyway.
CenturyLink
agrees with you. May want to think about
CenturyLink would agree with
technologically neutral.
Right, and that's the reason why the FCC went the direction they did.
Well, and I guess a clarification on that to either of the last two. When you say match up with the feds, are you talking about defining what the state of Utah views voice service as in terms of a list of features, irrespective of the technology, or are you talking about going to the actual federal LifeLine definition of the program?
Well, I don't have it in front of me, to be honest. I was prepared on this particular item, but I do recall that there is definition under the federal rule about what will qualify for federal LifeLine in terms of the technology. Our recommendation would be that you look at that as probably the best model.
Of course, the issue of capability of the line, for example, unlimited use option, I mean, that's a decision the state can make that would be different from the federal. And, in fact, I think that's what the commission's already decided in initial.
Well, in the previous rule, certainly.
I've got the language from the order if you want me to read a paragraph, which doesn't totally describe it, but I think it sheds some insight, perhaps. Okay. It says, in the USF ICC transformation order in FNPRM, the commission eliminated its former list of 9 supported services and amended section 54101A of its rules to specify that voice telephony service is supported by the federal universal service mechanisms. The commission found this to be a more technologically neutral approach, which is what we're using, that focuses on the functionality offered and not on the specific technology used to provide the supported service, while allowing services to be provided over any technology platform. In adopting the new definition of voice telephony, the commission eliminated certain services and functionalities from the list of supported services, consistent with its findings regarding the evolution of the marketplace. So that kind of describes maybe why they took that approach.
If you use the terminology, though, voice telephony, we think that captures what you're trying to do there.
Well, it doesn't limit it to being a residential service
access
offering,
line. Yeah.
For example, I guess, or access in a traditional landline service.
All right, well, we will pass on those concerns to our commissioners. And
are we, is there going to be, you had indicated earlier that you wanted us to, or if there was any research on, for example, the state administrator having to do the annual certification for federal-only ETCs, and then this issue that I just haven't really focused on. Is there going to be another round of comments? Are you going to receive comments before you send out another, or the proposed rule, or how do you foresee the procedure happening?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I expect we're going to take what we received today and publish a rule using the rulemaking processes in the state, and then you'll have an opportunity to comment on the rule as it's proposed, and we'll see how close we come to something that works.
Is there any mechanism if they wanted to submit some of this information about a particular legislative citation to us? Can they just send a comment in this current?
No, well,
Can we do supplemental comments based on clarification?
Absolutely, and what we can do, just to be fair to people that aren't participating today, if you'd like that opportunity, why don't we just set a date in a comfortable period of time, 2 weeks or something, and we can notice it up tomorrow in this doc and allow any party to provide supplemental information based on the discussions that have occurred today. Would that meet your needs?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay, so we will, as I say, we'll pass on this discussion to the full commission in terms of should this be rewritten to be technology neutral, if so, how to do that. But I think we've got a flavor for what the parties are talking about there.
Just to clarify, I couldn't quite hear the discussion, but the federal rules are clear that Lifeline has to be applied to residential voice service, so that doesn't deviate from your state rules. It's 54401B.
Yeah. Yes, certainly, and thank you for that. One of the things they were talking about, though, was it talked about not only being residential in our current rule, but also that it was an access line, and there's a few key phrases throughout that section that would tend to push one toward thinking of a legacy type network, and that's what a lot of the comments were about, was just is there a way to rewrite that in a technology neutral manner, and that's the idea that we're going to go back to the commission with and ask them to if they like that idea or not. But we're absolutely aware that that it's a residential program. Anything else on that section? Okay, thank you. Section 7, I think it is the shortest one in our current list. The service features of the federal. Some of the comments that we got were simply saying that we ought to explicitly reference the federal definitions. So it's a little bit more clear there, but and that certainly we can work along those lines. But any beyond that, is there anything there that would need to be addressed in the state rule?
Hey, John, sorry, back to 6, the non-recurring charge waiver.
Yes.
Now, the state program in the past, we used to, like, if you had a change order charge to add a customer to Lifeline, they were already a customer. We used to report that, and there was actually a reimbursement of non-recurring charges because we waived the charges. The question I think we raise is, given the fact that LinkUp's pretty well gone away, do we just eliminate any type of service order credits for customers because there's no mechanism for reimbursement, or is it the intent that that still would be a requirement of a state ETC, and then we would get reimbursement for that service order activity for the non-recurring revenues foregone?
I don't think that's saying that, the old LinkUp stuff, is it? It's just saying if someone has phone service and they change it from a local service to a Lifeline, there's not going to be a charge to add the Lifeline service to that line.
Yeah, but in the past, when we did those, there was actually reimbursement from the state program. We used to submit every six months the service order activity.
That doesn't apply anymore. That was changed a while back, where the reimbursement doesn't apply on this one.
Okay. When was that changed? Do you remember?
For me.
Long time.
Yeah.
we'll ask the commission about that issue, about reimbursement. All right. Anything on 7? I don't think so. Okay. Reporting requirements, section 8.
I think it needs to be clear that this applies to state ETCs, not federal ETCs.
I'd be so bold to object to the whole section.
I'm sorry.
Right. I'm reporting.
Is it being interpreted that it will only apply to state ETCs?
Yeah. This is the reason for this reporting is so that they can be reimbursed for their foregone revenues. So this is the reimbursement section.
You can skip it.
I'm not sure that immediately clear from the language. That's the intent.
Right.
Yeah. So that's why I say I think it needs to be defined. This applies to state ETCs only.
So there isn't anything in there that you feel we need from the federal ETCs?
Yeah. Every 6 months you get...
So you'll already get Form 555 from us.
Right. That's true. That's true.
Yeah, I send it to Carol Bird.
Check?
Yeah. 3 times a year.
Check with Carol.
That check's going. I don't...
Okay, well, we will we'll pass that on, but it certainly sounds logical to do it that way.
There was some comments regarding the administrative costs for advertising or outreach or those types of efforts. Do you want to address that?
Well, the idea is if the commission doesn't mandate advertising or outreach, if you do, then we ought to get reimbursed for those costs. And historically, we had in the past. I mean, it might have been a number of years, but we used to, like, if we're going to run an ad in a senior citizen paper, we'd get pre-approval from the commission, and then they would reimburse us for the cost of the ad. There are requirements that you do outreach on a federal basis. You just let that happen. But if the commission is not going to require, then there shouldn't be reimbursement. Because the provider has taken it on their own accord to decide to do that. So that was the thought behind it. I don't know if anybody else, has anybody been seeking advertising cost reimbursement?
Yes, there are ETCs who do, and one of the concerns that the divisions had is that the administrative costs are extremely varied. They're not consistent across the board, and we provided some information to the commission on that previously. So we think that needs to be addressed either formally or pre-approved for these types of activities when they go out and do a big blitz or something like that, so that there's not one that's benefiting and others aren't, or it's more consistent across the board.
Well, it gives you control of the administrative costs, which ultimately come out of the universal service.
Right, right.
So up front, if you say, yeah, we want to really... hit lifeline enrollment and we're going to require providers, then we could seek reimbursement for those expenses.
All right, we will pass that on. See what they say.
I guess, may I clarify on number 8? Using the check for a revenue number multiplied by the number we report to you.
Right.
It doesn't include interest accrual, it doesn't include administrative advertising program expenses, and it doesn't give an amount of foregone revenue resulting from the discounts provided.
If you state it, it does. If you request it, it does.
So if you include this information in the report?
Well, and this is... not saying the commission would go this way, but one option is we might just work on a standardized report.
Right.
So, that would make from an accounting perspective, it seems like more money spent chasing those dollars than it is worth keeping track of.
It really depends. I mean, we in the past, going back, we used to, when we de-enrolled, we would track that through a group that did that, and then those were administrative costs that we were allowed to recover.
Right.
Because they were significant. Now, we haven't done that for a long time. All we're basically doing is sending over a report and said, okay, we gave the discount on this many customers each month,
right,
so that we get their monthly revenues foregone.
And that's what some ETCs are doing. They're just doing that part of it. Others ETCs
are going more extensive.
They're still gathering their administrative costs, they're gathering their advertising costs, gathering the interest. So...
So do you audit those expenses at all?
Mm-hmm. If it's reasonable, we recommend it being reimbursed.
It'd be nice if there was a standardized way.
But it would be nice, because we have some ETCs that now, because of the population's dropping, their administrative costs are higher than the amount that we're reimbursing them on, the $3.50 per line.
They're paying more in administrative costs than the monthly.
Right. So there seems to be a skew as to how this is happening, you know?
We will pass it on. I'm sure they'll be interested.
So in light of that, I mean, I think essentially we just want consistency and make it clear.
And everybody uses different methodologies. Some use an administrative cost per line. Some use it based on actual cost and divide it by month. Some, you know, have just a flat amount that they use, and they've justified it based on prior experience. So everybody uses a different methodology.
So we could do a cost study that says on average administrative cost per line.
If you want to get in big trouble.
I didn't say that. You want to get into a cost proceeding?
You want, really want to do that, Jim.
We will
pass that on to the commission and see if they
can
come up with some ideas. All right. Funding of Lifeline. We tried to change that to be clear that we're funding the state, that state discount, where that's coming from. But any other comments on that section? Or there? That's pretty straightforward. And then just, we promise to pay you if you submit a bill for Section 10.
Yep.
As long as they're reasonable, yes.
Well, that's why the audit's in there.
All right. So that gets us through the specific sections, but in reading the comments, there were some comments that seemed more general. Are there any other issues that people wish to discuss regarding the program in Utah that we haven't directly addressed yet? Yes, sure.
I just have one comment. I didn't notice this before, but when it talks about collection and disbursement, this says that the ETC is going to file the report or bill, and it will be audited, and then it will be paid. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't say anything about paid, any allowance or disallowance for auditing errors, for mistakes, or for something you deem to be not reasonable. I mean, basically it's saying submit something, we'll pay it. That's how I'm reading it.
I think those are good points to take up.
Just as an example, when we do the recertification, if their numbers come in and they're higher than what the recertification numbers show they should have dropped, we will question it and say, wait a minute, your number's this, and your number should have dropped down to this. Why are you still asking for reimbursement for this number instead of this number?
And I am not questioning that you're not doing that. Yeah. I'm just saying the rule.
She's questioning the language of the rule. Doesn't necessarily really
Right.
But there is a review process, and the audit process goes through that.
Yeah, she's just saying that the rules should recognize that process exists, and that we only pay on the result of that process, not the initial.
Right.
So that's good to know. All right, any other general comments? What a deal, you just all made my day. Okay, let me just very quickly summarize what I believe will happen next. As Commissioner Clark noted, we will send out a notice allowing for additional comments in this current docket
to be due in two weeks.
Is 2 weeks acceptable? I'm assuming that should be enough time to... But, do you have concerns with 2 weeks? Or?
No, I think we're fine.
Oh, okay.
Where we're at, I'm not sure we'll have anything.
Yeah, I'm not sure anybody will, but there were just a few specifics. We said, you know, if you have a citation for that,
2 weeks is fine.
Certainly any of that type of stuff, or if you have a great brainstorming, feel free. So that will happen in this docket. The commission will take all the comments we've heard. We have this recorded. We have notes we've taken. We will respond to these, or the commissioners will respond to these, and we will draft a rule, which we'll then send through the state's formal administrative rule process. I'm pretty sure everybody here has gone through that. But just to briefly summarize it, we submit that, they publish it, then there's an open comment period, there's a period we evaluate the comments, and then one of two things happens. If all the comments come back and say, this is wonderful, cool, then we probably publish, then we make it effective. If there's some substantive things that come back that we need to respond to, and it's judged by the commission to respond, then that goes through a second round, and we republish a rule adjusted for the adjustments are. That continues until you get something that the commission feels is acceptable, and then they make it effective. So the last chance to comment before that process starts would be this two-week thing, if there's something else you want to get in while we're drafting that rule.
John, when the rule is published, will for comment, will notification be sent to the parties? Or do we just have to watch your website?
I'm assuming there's a way to send notification. I think when we publish, well, we can certainly send out.
It usually just goes on the website.
There's a docket, though.
Well, the problem is that it's a
separate. But it becomes a different thing.
Yeah, it becomes a different thing once it's published.
It goes through the rulemaking process. But I guess the question is more of a courtesy to those that have participated in here.
Right.
When you send it in to publish, could they also distribute? Even by email would be helpful. Then we know.
Or even just a notice that you should go to the website and it's there.
So shouldn't they, if they just, whatever this is, make change, we'd be notified.
Except it's not going to be in his docket.
Well, put a notice out there. We will do whatever the commission thinks is a good way to let you know. I mean, I think the idea is obviously one that, you know, we don't want to try and sneak anything by, and we don't want to cause problems. When things are published, they only get published on 2 days of the month, so it's not, you know, there are things like that. But yeah, we will investigate the best way to let people know, and we will do whatever we can. I just don't know exactly what we can. I'm guessing there's a couple of easy things, but it's a guess. So I'll let the attorneys deal with it. So that's where we plan to go from here. I guess that's about it. So anything else anybody has they need to bring up? Again, just let me thank you on behalf of the commission. We tremendously appreciate the comments. They were very helpful, very, very detailed, and very useful. And we will see you again sometime this month.
Thank you, John.
Very much.
All right.
I'm going to just show
you.
I think you were the one that brought this up a couple of days.
Was Linda?
Yeah.
Push our off button on the phone there for us.
Your off button.
Whatever it is, hang up button.
This says the phone number that says filed in February.
I really can't hear you now.
Our January.
Yes, indeed.
Let me check today. She from JSI. That they thought it was, and actually you texted me something recently that said, use your March
27th,
and I'm going,
but
that's it directly.
Well, I've got to be a phone
and
hold visible,
and this is what we've
been.
Well, that's what she was saying.
That just is a fact.